Hello, this is Fight Back, a podcast by the Healthcare Consumer Rights Foundation. I'm Steve Poizner, founder and executive director. Our nonprofit's mission is to help you navigate the complex healthcare system and understand your legal rights, options, and opportunities when you encounter problems and obstacles. We want to empower you with the information you need to fight back and get the best possible care. Today, we are featuring special guest and lifestyle medicine expert, Dr. Kate Collings, Director of Lifestyle Medicine at El Camino Hospital and President of the American College of Lifestyle Medicine. Lifestyle medicine focuses on educating and motivating patients to change personal habits and behaviors around using a whole food, plant-predominant diet, regular physical activity, restorative sleep, stress management, avoidance of risky substances, and positive social connection. Cardiovascular disease and type 2 diabetes, once thought to be irreversible, are just a couple of conditions that lifestyle interventions have helped to improve. Our discussion with Dr. Collings about how lifestyle medicine can make a huge difference for your health is informative and revealing. Let's get started. Dr. Collings, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you, Steve. It's really an honor to be here. It's a great podcast, and I listened to some of your other podcasts, including The Food as Medicine and the valuable work at the Health Trust, and the recent one on healthcare economics with Sean Flynn, which all of these topics relate to lifestyle medicine. And I also just love that your podcast is about empowering people. Because lifestyle medicine is very much about empowerment. And I'll share something about that later in the interview if I can.
Well, that sounds great. I think the term lifestyle medicine, people can imagine what that means. But I mean, you've devoted a big percentage of your career being a leader in this area. Let's just start off with just a definition. What is lifestyle medicine? What is the goal of it?
Sure. So the most commonly used definition of lifestyle medicine and the one used by the national organization, the American College of Lifestyle Medicine and Lifestyle Medicine, and the one I've adopted in our lifestyle medicine department at El Camino Health is the use of lifestyle as a therapeutic intervention for the treatment and reversal of chronic disease. You know, so we're all about getting ahead of the chronic disease epidemics, you know, that are pulling down people and really pulling down our country. And the definition goes further explicitly using nutritional prescriptions centered on a whole food, plant-predominant eating pattern, you know, individualized exercise prescriptions that are tailored to chronic diseases, sleep and stress management support, programs to attend to misuse of substances, as well as recognition of positive social connections and relationships and the effect that they actually have on heart outcomes. And so these are the six domains, but you can see that they draw in some of the social determinants of health.
Right. So, Dr. Collings, is one of the goals here, is it to reduce the amount of pharmaceutical drugs people take, reduce the number of types of surgeries that you might need? Is that specifically one of the goals?
Right, that is, absolutely, Steve. And the goal is that because, you know, it's medications, if you think about them, are, you know, create, particularly when people get into polypharmacy, you know, a lot of side effects. And of course, medications are more costly than self-care. And so bringing down medication use, bringing down procedural use is really, you know, part of solving for healthcare economics. And I know that's something that you're quite interested in. Because really, the vast majority of the costs that are incurred both at the individual level and at the national level relate to these procedures and medications that are treating diseases that are lifestyle born and can be lifestyle treated. in the most cost-effective way.
Like diabetes.
Diabetes is a perfect example.
And cardiovascular disease, I assume, is another?
Absolutely. So if we look at, you know, these chronic diseases, cardiovascular disease and, you know, the things that can fall into that, stroke and hypertension and high lipids, high cholesterol, diabetes, prediabetes, you know, obesity and overweight, you know, these are the chronic diseases that are consuming healthcare dollars and, you know, deaths and disability, and not to mention COVID risks. And, you know, those are the conditions that are so lifestyle born. They're really lifestyle related conditions. And so by applying lifestyle to those, the vast majority of what we treat, we really, you know, can take it a whole long ways.
Well, I have to confess, I'm a case in point. You know, my LDL, which I, you know, track carefully with my doctor over time, mm-hmm. was going up. And then my doctor asked me about my diet, and I told my doctor how much I love to eat cheese. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, stop eating cheese and see what happens. And, you know, lo and behold, my LDL went straight down when I cleaned up my diet.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just cheese, honestly, with some Taco Bell as well. I mean, it just, you know, getting, you know, out of the habit of eating fast foods and so forth. But, you know, a lot of people just go on medications for cholesterol, right? But
absolutely.
At least in my case, I know I can control it with my diet.
Right. And so you're a perfect example of, hey, we have someone who, you know, that you don't want to sit with that high LDL, but you have an opportunity now to do an experiment on yourself, and you did it. Let's go fully in to make these a deeper dive into nutrition, not just eating generally healthy, but really, you know, instrumenting on your diet pattern. And then let me see where I can get with it. And as you have seen, you can get a long ways with it. You know, once you get down to the specifics and, you know, understand these things. But I would say, I do want to shed a light that lifestyle medicine is, you know, is more than just what happens at that provider-patient level, which is so important. You know, it's one person by one person, of course. But at the bigger picture level, it really represents, you know, what we believe is true healthcare reform. It's the foundation of population health. And really, you know, the only way we can economically address the epidemic of chronic diseases. You know, at the same time that things are getting better for people, they feel better, they have more vitality and so forth.
Well, to what extent is lifestyle medicine, you know, a radical concept in the medical profession? I mean, is this considered an alternative medicine to traditional Western medicine?
You know, in lifestyle medicine, we don't really consider it alternative medicine. And so I would say decidedly not, but it is a definite paradigm shift. You know, if you look at other fields of medicine, like integrative medicine or complementary medicine, you know, they've been on the margins of what we might think of as allopathic or traditional medicine. And I'm obviously biased, but I think that this is different for lifestyle medicine. I think that we are, while we're not recognized fully in mainstream medicine, I think we are squarely in mainstream medicine. And I say that because, you know, treatment guidelines that come across, you know, whether it has to do with heart disease or endocrine or hypertension, you know, lifestyle counseling has existed in treatment guidelines, you know, for a long time. But there's a big difference between counseling and education. And actually, you know, using implementation and actually having people, you, Steve, are a success story, but many people are not. Sometimes that counseling and education just doesn't add up to lifestyle change for many people. And so, you know, people have to, you know, get into it in a little deeper way.
Right. You mentioned, you know, the importance of empowering patients and consumers. To what extent are you advising people who are listening to this podcast that it's your responsibility to bring this up with your doctor? You know, I guess it's a two-way street, yes?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I don't think it's going to be, you know, it's going to be typical that the doctor is going to, a doctor is going to refer for lifestyle intervention. You know, in my many years of cardiology practice, you know, I really thought I wore the hat of, you know, advising and counseling my patients. But, you know, the model I had really didn't allow me to go into it in as much detail as many, many patients need. And so, you know, it's not top of mind, and it certainly wasn't in my years in cardiology to say, oh, let me send you to somebody who has a specialty in lifestyle treatment. So patients really have to advocate to see a qualified professional. And, you know, there's many people who are so-called, right, lifestyle experts, you know, often unqualified and too often making large sums of money at the expense of people with supplements and things. So patients really need to advocate to see somebody who's lifestyle medicine trained. Fortunately, there are more and more providers. So I want to tell you that lifestyle medicine is certified since 2017, and the American Board of Lifestyle Medicine has certified more than 2,000 professionals, and worldwide, actually, more than that. So patients can advocate for referral to a lifestyle medicine specialist now. And with El Camino Health, you know, we have physicians trained in this, and our foundation has supported us in gaining scholarships to train more physicians, and we're also training some of our registered nurses so that they can help people in their bedside care,
right?
Which I find to be really exciting.
Well, Dr. Collings, you're such an expert here. I would love to get into some topics next that where listeners can walk away with some specific advice on certain areas that they may be, you know, struggling with. You know, for example, smoking. I have a bunch of friends who simply cannot stop smoking. And everyone knows the damage that's done when you smoke. But it's hard. You know, it's addictive and hard to stop. Any suggestions for people out there that would like to try a new approach?
Well, you know, I'll say that this is smoking. You're absolutely right. Is terribly addictive. You know, other things, and it is a big part of lifestyle medicine. Other things that are also addictive, right? Food is quite addictive. The internet, as opposed to going out for a walk, is addictive. But, you know, there are national quit lines for people with respect to tobacco. And there are medications that can augment and help people get a jump start, if you will, to discontinuing tobacco. But, you know, the approach that I really think is just the bedrock of so much that we do in lifestyle behavior change has to do with people visioning, really, where do they want to see their health and what in 1 year or 3 years or 5 years, and why do they want to see it there? And I would venture then in the case of smoking, for most people nowadays, they absolutely know the health risks of smoking. But they have to be, you know, fostered and facilitated to imagine how their life would be better and how it might look different for them. And so some of that comes through physicians in the way they approach patients rather than, you know, pointing a finger and shaking a finger. It's really coming in through a coach's lens as opposed to an expert lens. And, you know, that's some of the work that is so valuable in lifestyle medicine and can be applied across the domains of however we're helping people. But it is getting people engaged in their why.
Right. I guess same thing about diet, I suppose. So any suggestions for people who, you know, they start diets, they lose weight, and then they stop the diet and they have to, you know, go back on a diet and a few months later, what do you suggest in terms of ways to make your changes to your diet more permanent?
Right. That's a great question. Well, you know, I think that the first thing is, you know, we've grown up in a culture where, you know, the word diet is used. And I oftentimes like to get people to stop thinking about diet because diet so often relates to weight loss. And there's plenty of ways to lose weight quickly that also equate to regaining that same 20 pounds. And so you're really getting at the core, it's eating as a way of life, as a lifestyle. And getting on a pattern of eating through working with specialists that is sustainable. And it takes ideally take the eyes off the scale a little bit and off the mirror enough to begin to eat in a way that nourishes the body and has all the positive effects across the board in chronic disease. And as a positive side effect, allows people to lose weight and maintain their weight loss. And that, you know, again, when we get down to it in taking a bit of a lens off of calories altogether and off of the scale and off of the mirror and go for what nourishes the body. And we know what that does and go for the long-term health outcomes and find the most flavorful way of doing that. Now, one of the ways that we do that at El Camino Health and is done across the country is in cooking classes and what we call culinary medicine. So again, it's not just what people eat or don't eat, but it's really how they prepare their foods. And as an example, and of how they can get a sustainable weight management in line.
Right. If people want to learn more about culinary medicine that you just mentioned, I mean, what do you recommend for more information there?
Well, we have a culinary medicine classes through El Camino Health. And so those are available to anyone. They're available to people that are part of our network, but also people can sign up who are out of our network. And they can do that through elcaminohealth.com/lifestylemedicine. And they'll find classes and events, and they can sign up through that. It's not to the benefit of the audience, but there are a number of medical schools that have embedded curriculum for their physicians, Stanford being one of them, to teach, not physicians yet, medical students, I would say, how to cook healthy so that we know that physicians who practice good lifestyle and good self-care are most likely to counsel their patients accordingly in a similar way to bring those same health benefits to their patients. And so there are other places around the country where there are, you know, if you will, patient-facing culinary classes. But I think we're pretty unique in the Bay Area in really offering that to the public.
All online?
All online now, right.
Right, sure. You mentioned plant-based nutrition. What's that all about?
Well, so if you look at plant-based nutrition, if we just step back and look from a number of different angles at eating patterns, we can start with the blue zones of the world, the areas across the world where people have the longest disability-free life. And what we find in those, and these are people that, you know, practice their eating pattern because of their geography and their cultural norms and so forth. If we look across that, those populations and those communities are predominantly, not always exclusively, but predominantly plant-focused in their consumption of foods. And if we contrast that with a more Western approach, where we've had largely animal products at the center of our plate and, plant materials at the periphery of our plate or at the margins of our plate. You know, we bought into this pure protein mentality, you know, a few decades ago. And, you know, I would say that, you know, if we can map out diabetes, if we map out obesity, you know, this pattern, along with certainly the processed foods, has diminished our health. It certainly hasn't augmented our health. So Plant Predominant is saying that we're aiming to bring people along the spectrum of eating patterns where what fills their plate are plants, vegetables, fruits, legumes, whole grains, nuts, seeds, because this is really where we get, where we can really use food as medicine in this way to, you know, increase the antioxidant qualities of what they're eating, the anti-inflammatory qualities, and tap down chronic diseases. You know, in the last of the Journal of American Cardiology editions, I should promoted and, you know, looked at the foods that tap down inflammation or ramp up inflammation. And for those in the audience that don't know that term of inflammation, they may have heard of it, but really inflammation is sort of the chronic, is the underlying reason for most of our chronic diseases, you know, whether that is right. Diabetes or heart disease. And so foods can rapidly increase inflammation, or they can rapidly tap down inflammation. And as an example, on their infographic, dark green leafy vegetables and berries and fruits and vegetables were the top three anti-inflammatory foods. And so, you know, this is not new. You know, if we look across the populations, if we look at the scientific studies coming out through the schools of nutrition and so forth, we really know that, you know, food is the number one cause of death and disability. You know, we may say cardiovascular disease is, but the real cause is lifestyle.
Right. Do you actually recommend people to try to become a vegetarian if they can? Do you think that's the ultimate?
Well, you know, the vegetarian, you know, there's a lot of different terminology out there, Steve, and that's actually why I really try to focus on the plant predominant. And let me explain why. You know, if you look at health outcomes, vegetarians and vegans as a whole that practice those eating patterns in the healthy form, you know, definitely have better health outcomes, better weight management and everything across chronic diseases. But oftentimes those, if you will, when they're called diets, they get skewed, right? And they incorporate a lot of unhealthy foods. So not everybody practices a vegetarian diet as it was conceived of, if you will. You as an example, and any other vegetarian might just say, oh my goodness, I have to add cheese to everything, right?
Right.
You know, somebody who takes a vegan approach might say, oh, I need to shop the vegan aisle of the grocery store. So, you know, in that case, we haven't really accomplished anything in terms of the different problems with processed foods and additives and everything. So if we take a really whole food, plant predominant focus on in terms of eating pattern, we sort of cut through some of those other issues in my mind.
Right.
And that other terminology.
So if you can't eat a perfect diet, or even if you do you recommend, you know, supplements? You mentioned that earlier, that there's a lot of ripoffs out there. People have to be, you know, on the lookout. But what about probiotics and vitamins to help? And, you know, and there's, you know, I guess anti-inflammatories in those supplements too, at least they claim.
Right. Well, you know, like everyone else, I love I love the thought that I can simply, you know, put something in a, you know, in a supplement form, you know, and take it, slug it down in the morning with breakfast and imagine that I will be healthier. That's a very, very appealing, simple thing. And then I can just get on with the rest of my day, right? But I just haven't found the literature has supported that. And over I go back to it. I recently dove into the fish oil again, always trying to, you know, look at that. And I'll tell you, I get disappointed over and over. One study, you know, yes. And the next study, no, it didn't have any effect. The levels didn't relate to outcomes in acute myocardial infarction and so forth and so on. So, you know, I've been universally disappointed with supplements and prebiotics. I don't think they're there. Whereas a plant predominant diet does basically the job of all of that, right? Maybe not in the fish oil department, but you can get your omega-3s and so forth through plant sources.
Right.
And then you are, you know, the microbiome is this whole concept that you're getting at with the prebiotics or probiotics. But really, it's our food, which is the prebiotic, right? Mm-hmm. You know, our food nourishes the right microbial balance in our gut. And it's that which, you know, creates the immunity and the that we're seeking in a probiotic. So I really think of as food as a prebiotic. You know, maybe in an acute disease situation, somebody who's had, you know, recent gastrointestinal disease, you know, some of the real severe cases that I've seen in my clinical years in the hospital, there may be a role for probiotics in the recovery of that gut. But in everyday life, I haven't yet found the balance of evidence that supports that.
I see. Now, I have a close relative who's has celiac disease, and she's allergic to gluten, so she's on a gluten-free diet, you know, by necessity. But of course, gluten-free diets are kind of a fad out there too. I mean, what's your view on gluten?
Well, I'm going to first tell you, Steve, that I'm not an expert at that. But what I know from my, you know, nutrition colleagues and so forth is, yeah, certainly there are folks out there that are true celiac and need to be on this gluten-free diet. You know, there's some other people that may be relatively gluten intolerant, but maybe not celiac, who do improve with the reduction of gluten in their diet. But I think it's a bit, you know, I think some people may just simply improve because they're taking a lot of processed nonsense out of their diet. And so while they go at it from a gluten standpoint and see if they get better, are they really getting better by reducing the gluten, or are they just getting better because they're, you know, now conscientious about their diet and what they consume and mindful of it, and therefore, you know, getting rid of a lot of the nonsense and starting to, you know, eat for health.
Right. Well, let's talk about stress management for a second. Another one of those areas that you mentioned is important in lifestyle medicine, especially during the pandemic. Everyone's stress level, you know, has been way up for a whole bunch of, you know, reasons. Mm-hmm. What's your advice, you know, for people on how to best manage stress?
Right. Yeah. It's so important. I mean, it would be a surprise. I know I've certainly felt it at a personal level as well. I look at stress management and its best, which is conditioning our nervous system, right? We have this fight or flight system. That's our sympathetic nervous system. And we have the rest and digest, which is our parasympathetic nervous system. And if you put them together, it's our autonomic nervous system. And we want to get the right balance out of that. Just like we're talking about getting the right diet, just as we condition ourselves exercise-wise, right? We go through conditioning for exercise, and we have to find that great mix of aerobic and weight resistive, you know, training. Similarly, we have to condition our autonomic nervous system. And that's where, you know, whatever technique works for someone, something that's centering, we can call it mindfulness, we can call it meditation, we can call it breathing. But it really does, we really can see the physiological effects, the real physiological effects on the autonomic nervous system when people practice something, the, you know, whatever kind of meets their style of that, you know, time, centering time through meditation, through mindfulness, through breathing, through reading even, right? That we really see the changes in the autonomic nervous system. This is very measurable. And it also, you know, in real terms, people can, when they do this, can kind of feel that they're less reactive. And so, you know, we use a number of different techniques and have used in our program. One is called HeartMath. I think it's particularly an interesting app and technique that's been developed by a company called HeartMath because it really has the physiological data behind it. And yeah, it's so important in our time. So yes,
right.
I can't agree with you more.
Yeah. I've been experimenting a little bit with meditation. It can be challenging to master it and to stick with it, but it's, I definitely find it super helpful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Great.
Yeah. And so, you know, as I've gotten older, you know, and as my friends have gotten older, you know, getting a good night's sleep, you know, is harder and harder. Mm-hmm. Of course, sleep is so important. When I don't get a good night's sleep, I definitely, you know, feel the effects of it the next day. Suggestions on sleep management.
Right. So, you know, the first and foremost, we do kind of have to look at screening people and being smart and screening them for sleep apnea. You know, sometimes it's a bit more insidious. We can obviously think of sleep apnea, which is the obstruction of the airway, you know, and low oxygen levels that occur as that happens through the night. And as you know, we need to screen for that. That's important because that has, you know, big health outcomes.
And that requires a sleep study.
Correct. And that requires a sleep study. But, you know, sleep hygiene is where most people, you know, once we've pretty assured that an individual doesn't have sleep apnea, then it really the focus needs to be on sleep hygiene. You know, and that has to do with, you know, blue light, what we get from our devices. It has to do with, you know, how we go through our rituals in preparing ourselves for bed. You know, how close to bed we might consume alcohol, you know, and what we do to wind down. So that kind of brings you back to the stress management so that, you know, people aren't ruminating or waking up with ruminating thoughts.
Right. I think Lunesta and Ambien are two of the best-selling prescription drugs out there, for sleep aid. I mean, do you ever see a role for those type of sleeping aids?
You know, I wouldn't say I would never, but it certainly wouldn't be a first approach. I mean, I think where things like that can be, you know, kind of lifesavers is when somebody goes through some, you know, acute stress, right? The death of a loved one, something like that, where they just cannot get the number of hours that they need to be able to then manage. You know, they kind of get into a sleep deprivation, stress, cycle. And so I think that there is certainly a use, but as a chronic measure of sleep management, I think that it's a slippery slope. We know that particularly in folks as they get older, and you can draw the line wherever you want that to be, certainly we're changing. You know, we need to be so aware of cognitive function. And I worry about the medications and their effect on that in chronic use.
Right. Well, my last question here, Dr. Collings, and it's you know, the New Year's is coming up here. Everyone makes New Year's resolutions. You know, often, you know, a few weeks after the beginning of the year, those resolutions are long gone and people have forgotten about them. Any advice for our listeners about making a resolution or two about a lifestyle change and really figuring out a way to sticking with it?
Yeah, that's a great question. And yes, we're coming up on January 1. We love to see people at that time because they're fully activated, right? And as you said, people sort of start out the new year with, you know, enormous, this year is going to be different. We do that on all sorts of things. But oftentimes things, you know, fall down after that, after some period of time. So, you know, the advice is, you know, that I can give is to, you know, fully prepare yourself in options, create structure. And this is, you know, what we do when we meet with patients. It's setting, you know, goals, and it's setting realistic goals, or what we call SMART goals, so that we begin the journey. That, you know, sometimes for many people, it's small steps that add up. And, you know, if people come in with unrealistic expectations of themselves, and they're not fully prepared to do that at this particular time in their life, they're sort of setting themselves up for failure. So sometimes a better way is to come in with modest goals, you know, figure out how you're going to create structure. And I would again say, health coaches, you know, all of us in our department take an approach of goal setting, but realistic goals for people at the stage of change that they're able, that they're at emotionally, and what they're ready to do, given all the other circumstances of their life. And so meeting people where they are is really important. But people also have to have that self-insight. You know, I think it's just so unfortunate when people wish for the best but don't set themselves up for it. Because, you know, that alone is a setback, which makes it harder to come back to their resolution. Because they're not feeling successful. So we have to help people to feel successful as they go along. That's the only way to get the sustainability so that they can stay on course.
Excellent. Thank you, Dr. Collings. This is wonderful information for our listeners. Really appreciate you being on the podcast today.
Thank you, Steve. It was an honor and a pleasure. Thank you.
I want to thank you for listening to today's Fight Back podcast. Our mission is to provide you with the healthcare resources and information in a refreshing and interesting format. I also want to thank Dr. Collings for joining us on our podcast today and providing you, our listeners, with the information you need to keep yourselves, family, friends, and community healthy. For more information, please visit our website at www.healthcareconsumerrights.org. While on our website, you can check out additional podcasts or access more information and resources to help you navigate this healthcare system and get the care you deserve. We also welcome your input and stories that we can use on future podcasts. This is Steve Poizner, and this is Fight Back, a podcast by the Healthcare Consumer Rights Foundation. Thanks for listening. I look forward to our next podcast. Talk with you soon.